Welcome back. This is actually take two for the recording of this episode.
Yes.
Unfortunately, and why it's taken us a little while to get this one out.
A mysterious audio goblin infected our previous recording, our first attempt at having this conversation.
Which we didn't catch until Dave sat down to edit and heard the...
The terrible distortion on our voices that I still don't know why it's there.
Which is not there today, despite not having changed anything about the setup. So. Yeah.
Different day.
Yeah. I will refrain from discussing the patterns in the firmament for this, but.
Yeah.
No one is surprised.
Yeah. But anyway, you won't notice.
No.
That this is take two.
That's going to be better and shorter, possibly. We'll see.
We'll see.
Yeah. So, a reminder, this episode, as we mentioned at the end of the last one, we are going to go off book for a moment.
Yes.
And discuss the original Garden of Eden myth that becomes sort of a motif throughout the book or a touch point in the David's narrative and criticism of other thinkers. And we're going to look at that story and of different readings of that story over time.
Yeah, if you've been reading the book, or even if you've just been listening to our podcast here, then you've probably noticed that this accusation keeps coming up where Graeber and Wengrow accuse different ways of telling the story of humanity, different anthropological takes on modes of subsistence or something like that, as just being recapitulations of the Garden of Eden's fall narrative, right, from the book of Genesis. And probably like the central nemesis, I would say, of the book along these lines would be the story of like agriculture being the fall.
Right.
For those of us for whom the ideas discussed in The Dawn of Everything are not particularly new, this is a familiar story.
Mm-hmm.
The story that as hunter-gatherers, humans lived, you know, more or less like, I don't know, as we should be or something.
Mm-hmm.
But then we made the fateful move of adopting agriculture, after which we have now suffered the consequences, you know, and the consequences, you know, there's all kinds of takes on exactly what those were, but, you know, hierarchy, statecraft, I mean, just, I don't know, all kinds of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in that way of storytelling, the adoption of agriculture is the fall.
Right. But it's important to know that agriculture has not always been one of the interpretations of this story.
Yeah, for sure.
In fact, a large percentage of the interpretations over time don't have that as a framework at all.
Yeah, right. As we're going to get into, there's lots of different ways to even read what is the important part of the Garden of Eden story, right? The pattern that's taken up by the Dawn of Everything and these types of readings is that the important part is that the expulsion from the garden represents a momentous like change of life, a way of being from which we can't go back.
Right. Any kind of like irrevocable choice would be a common framework, whether or not that's agriculture or other or sinning in general.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, something that you cannot go turn back from.
Yeah. Yeah. But we wanted to dig into this a little bit further because, as is usually the case with myth, there is just a lot packed in to these stories, to these dense nuggets of narrative. And there's a lot that can be read in and unpacked, and a lot has over time. And so is there room to do something even like kind of differently than what the Davids are doing? Because what the Davids do is that they sniff out fall narratives so that they can be rejected.
Right.
Right. And, but we want to explore if there's ways that these types of stories about momentous changes, you know, about moments of disobedience or overreach or crossing a threshold mm-hmm. in some way can be read in a different way, in a liberatory way.
Right. Yeah. And there is a long history of this.
Yeah.
So before we discuss that history, I think it's important for us to actually read the story. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be reading chapter 3 of the book of Genesis. And this particular edition I'm going to read from is the Revised Standard Version. So it's kind of like a little bit modernized version of the King James Version, but it seems to be still very, still feels and smells like the King James Version without as much of the archaic language.
It's slightly less stilted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't actually know the history of the edition, but I'm actually picking it. I'm reading this, the part that's selected from Elaine Pagel's Adam, Eve, and the Serpent. So that is why I chose this edition, actually, is because it was serviceable for her. It will be serviceable for us.
Very well.
Chapter 3. So at this point in the story of creation,
yeah,
Adam's already a character. God has made up all the animals to keep him company. He's named them. He's still kind of... He's fine, but maybe God thinks he might feel better if he had a helpmate, as they call Eve. Right. And so he's already taken Adam's rib, made Eve, mm-hmm. and he's put them together in the garden with only one rule. mm-hmm. And that rule being, do not eat from the tree that's in the middle of the garden. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you even
or
touch it...
Or as they say in the story, in the midst.
In the midst of the garden. Yes.
Yes.
And if you... He told them they would die if they even touch the tree. So yeah. That's their only rule.
Right.
All right. So chapter 3 of Genesis. Now the serpent was more subtle than any other wild creature that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman... Did God say, you shall not eat of any tree of the garden? And the woman said to the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden. But God said, you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden. Neither shall you touch it, lest you die. But the serpent said to the woman, you will not die. For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took up its fruit and ate. And she also gave some to her husband, and he ate. Then the eyes of both were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. And they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. But the Lord God called to the man and said to him, where are you? And he said, I heard the sound of thee in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself. He said, who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree of which I commanded you not to eat? The man said, the woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me the fruit of the tree, and I ate. Then the Lord God said to the woman, what is this that you have done? The woman said, the serpent beguiled me, and I ate. The Lord God said to the serpent, because you have done this, cursed are you above all cattle and above all wild animals. Upon your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat all the days of your life. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. To the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your pain and childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children, yet your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. And to Adam he said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth to you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken. You are dust, and to dust you shall return. The man called his wife's name Eve, because she was the mother of all living. And the Lord God made for Adam and for his wife garments of skins and clothed them. Then the Lord God said, "Behold, the man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. And now, lest he put forth his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever." Therefore the Lord God sent him forth from the Garden of Eden to till the ground from which he was taken. He drove out the man, and at the east of the Garden of Eden, he placed a cherubim and a flaming sword, which turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life.
That's right. Yeah. So let's go over some of the key points here.
Okay.
From what we have just learned.
A lot happens in a short amount of time.
Yeah. Adam and Eve are in the garden. They're naked.
Mm-hmm.
But they have no knowledge of being naked, really.
Right.
They don't even have a concept of naked.
Right.
And then the serpent comes and asks his leading question. Mm-hmm. He's like, "Oh, are you allowed to eat of every tree?"
Mm-hmm. Right.
And Eve's like, "Oh, but this tree, or else we're going to die." And then the serpent says, "Oh, no, you won't die. He just told you that because he doesn't want you to be like him."
Right.
Right. At which point the tree suddenly looks good to eat and beautiful to Eve.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's very tempted.
Right.
And following the lead of the serpent, eats of the tree. She offers it to Adam. He eats. And then, you know, just the strange thing that of which so much has been made, that the first thing that happens, for one thing, the name of the tree is the tree of knowledge of good and evil.
Right.
Which is a very specific
kind of knowledge, yeah.
Right? It's not just a tree of knowledge in a general sense, you know, but the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And then when they eat the tree, the first thing that they gain knowledge of is their nakedness.
Yeah. They skips right to shame.
It skips right to shame. Yeah. And like, you know, the first thing that they want to do is cover their genitals, right?
That's true. That's true. They make aprons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then God comes along and is basically like, "Why are you hiding?"
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And discovers that they ate of the tree. And then, you know, everyone kind of passes the buck down the line. Adam's like, "She made me do it." And Eve's like, "The serpent made me do it." And so God curses the serpent.
Mm-hmm.
The serpent will forever be hated by people.
Mm-hmm.
And has to go on his belly and all that stuff. And not just him, but all serpents. His mm-hmm. seed as well. Mm-hmm. And then Eve is punished by having to have painful childbirth and having to be forever subservient to Adam, and by extension, all men.
Mm-hmm.
And then Adam, his curse is like...
It's intense.
Is intense in this way where God actually curses the ground on which Adam lives. And they are fatefully together cursed, where Adam will have to like toil to earn his sustenance from the cursed ground,
mm-hmm.
which will produce just weeds and thorns in Adam's path,
mm-hmm.
and he will have to like toil in order to gain sustenance from the cursed ground.
Right. Yeah, it's a heavy curse.
Yeah.
It is a heavy curse.
And then, as like a almost like an afterthought,
mm-hmm.
at the end, because God has meted out these punishments, and then God says, "Oh, wait, but now having eaten of this tree, they are already like me."
Like us.
Oh, yeah, like us.
Like, who's he talking to?
Right, like
that's the thing
gods.
That stands out to me the most, is I'm like, he's like this monotheistic God who's just like, "I'm an angry and jealous God."
Yeah.
He's like,
"I'm the one God.
I am the one God."
Yeah,
he's
right.
Like, they're going to be like us.
Yeah.
Anyway. Oops. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's funny that the later
slipped through.
That the later church fathers, that the compilers of the scripture and stuff never changed that to singular from the plural.
Right.
You know, still containing this relic of God being just one God
among many
gods.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, so he's like, "Well, okay, so they've eaten, so they're like me now. And if they eat from this other tree, the tree of life, which is so far not been mentioned, right?
Right.
Then they will be all the way like me. And so I must actually kick them out of the garden.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's like, he decides this at the end.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, oh, it's not enough for me to just punish them in these ways I already have. I mm-hmm. need to like not even let them be here.
Right.
And so he expels them from the garden, right?
Right. Yeah. Because there are actually two trees in the garden.
Right.
That he doesn't want them to eat from. The yeah. garden that he made mm-hmm. for them to live in.
Mm-hmm.
So there's also that part.
Right.
Yeah, so, yes, all of that is in there. What stands out to me is the, suddenly, his concern for them being more like him, being the reason they're pushed out of the garden,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting because the way that this story has been wielded to punish humans in so many systems and so many frameworks of understanding kind of ignores that part a uh-huh. little bit, you uh-huh. know? But part of why we wanted to read the story here is that there's a lot in there. It's mm-hmm. a mysterious text
mm-hmm.
full of aspects that any one of which you could go deep into and delve into. And some of the early readers of the Garden of Eden story did just that.
Yeah.
You know, at least, especially once we get into the current era after the birth of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And so our first stop on the possible liberatory readings of the Garden of Eden story is going to be the Gnostic Christians. Before we get into those liberatory readings, I want to acknowledge a couple of things about this story. So this story is in the Hebrew Bible
mm-hmm.
originally, but even before that, there are various themes that come from older Mesopotamian religions.
Yeah.
If you look into the actual origins of the Garden of Eden story, there is a story of a tree, a man walking in a garden in the beginning of time with a tree and a snake. And that is in, I think, both Akkadian and Sumerian literature. So from the Mesopotamian myths, this one was gleaned and refined and put into the Hebrew Bible. And something that's important to know here is that the early Israelite religion was one that was polytheistic before the creation of Judaism, you yeah. know? So you'll see a lot of different yeah. recurring themes and elements that predate this religion.
No one starts out monotheistic, really.
Oh, right. That's true, huh? Yeah. Generally, there's not one God.
Generally.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And the history of that and why that works is fascinating and interesting. Yeah. And there, yeah, we don't need to go into that right now. But monotheism often serves a political purpose.
Yeah.
It's a unifying mm-hmm. form of religion.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there's some level of schismogenesis that's often happening. Like the Israelites who were coming out of this Canaanite religion were wanting to distinguish themselves from their oppressors and from the people around them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this unifying story that proceeds from the Garden of Eden is partially them distinguishing themselves through rules about living,
yeah.
through preferences, through story, through history, in a way that says we are different from the others.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, for sure. And if you read the Old Testament, many episodes in the Old Testament are a story of Yahweh fighting to be
the one God.
The one God.
Right. Right.
Right. And the Israelites are often messing up, you know, like when Moses goes to the mountain and he comes back and the Israelites are worshiping.
They've got the golden calf.
They've got that bull. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And stuff. Right. So a lot of the stories are taking place, obviously, in a polytheistic world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the story of the one God establishing his place as the one God.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's just an aside. But yeah, that's the context
true. That's
of
true.
A lot of.
If you actually you know, return this. To that scripture, that those are often the stories.
Mm-hmm.
And when bad things happen to the Israelites, it's their fault. That's uh-huh. kind of like the underlying narrative as well. Or maybe not underlying.
For straying from
the faith.
Monotheism, basically,
yeah.
or something.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, mm-hmm. you know, or for assimilating into other culture, which included straying from monotheism.
Yeah.
You know, so that is part of the story. But back to the Garden of Eden, the early Christians. So I'm talking now like year zero, current era, up into 400. CE.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I'm saying, early Christians, what I'm referring to. And again, the earliest Christians were all Jewish people.
Sure.
They did not begin to convert people outside of the faith without outside of that lineage until later. That came with Paul.
Yeah.
But just to clarify, I'm talking about Christianized Jewish people at the very beginning, and then that changes over time.
Yes.
But these early Christians were in an interesting place because there was no agreed upon text or agreed upon story. There were a lot of oral traditions. There were a lot of different apostles. There were a lot of different teachers and preachers and who were part of the emergence of this religion, right? So they're telling Jesus' stories. They're telling his followers'
stories. The stories of Jesus.
Primarily.
Yeah, which because there are agreed upon texts of the Old Testament.
Of the Old Testament, yes.
Yeah, but of the... Yes.
Well, at that point, it had not been completely solidified yet either. But yes. But yeah, so the Christian story itself is still kind of up in the air. But still, there are many echoes in what would become the New Testament and in the early Gospels that go back to the Hebrew Bible.
Yes.
You know, and so there's repeating patterns and stories within that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I'm emphasizing about there being kind of this open space is that there was a lot of up in the air about interpretation and about where this was going to go.
Yeah.
Right? And there was some freedom there, actually. Partially.
So like emerging Christianity,
yeah.
If I can synthesize kind of what you're saying, the emergence of the Christian sect within Judaism was, among other things, an opportunity to kind of re-envision the meaning of the faith and and including to read new meanings into the
works.
Old stories.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
Yeah.
And so... Part of what's interesting about this early Christian timeline, the first few hundred years, is that there were all of these sects, which were eventually called Gnostic sects, who had pretty radical readings of some of the old stories, especially the Garden of Eden story.
Yeah.
And Gnostic here, G-N-O-S-T-I-C, refers to the word for wisdom. But it's important to understand that it means knowledge gained through experience. It is personal wisdom attained through illumination or through study that you gain on your own.
Mm-hmm.
That it's really important to most of these sects that although you might have a teacher who shares their interpretation and their illumination with you, you have your own personal gnosis.
Yeah.
And your own personal interpretation.
Yeah.
And that's a really important part here. And that is something that was new within Judaism.
Right.
And will stand out against later forms of Christianity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because where we are not allowed much interpretation in not very long in the story or in the timeline, you know?
Uh-huh.
And from what I understand, the Gnostic Christians tended to be more educated. This was like a kind of higher... People with more access to education tended to be drawn to this.
That makes sense.
And a lot of women within that were drawn to this because there was relatively more freedom and power for women within the Gnostic readings. Which brings us to what some of the Gnostic readings of Genesis are. So I want to clarify here at the beginning that when we talk about the serpent... A lot happens to the serpent over time in the history of Christianity, and the serpent becomes conflated somewhat with both Lucifer and Satan. That's a fascinating history. We don't have time to go into all that today. Right now, at the beginning, in the Gnostic era, this is the serpent alone. Only serpent. There's no devil yet in the story.
Right. Right.
They don't have a devil.
The serpent's not the devil. The serpent is the serpent.
The serpent's just the serpent.
Right.
They are a character in a myth.
Yeah.
And that's another important thing is that the Gnostic Christians never thought this was a literal story.
Uh-huh.
They read the story and they thought, this is obviously not just how the world began. This is a mystery story with which you gain wisdom and insight and illumination by studying.
Yeah, through exegesis.
Through exegesis, right.
Yes.
And so at that time, from what it looks like with like Orthodox Jewish reading and Orthodox Christian reading of this time period, the story was taken to be literal with a lot of implications.
Mm-hmm.
There are exceptions to that. There were some Hellenized Jewish scholars, notably Philo of Alexandria, who saw it as an allegory to be explored. And so the early Gnostic Christians were actually in that lineage with the Hellenized Jewish writers.
Uh-huh.
So there was a tradition of that, but the main, like the more orthodox thinking was one of literal reading. Mm-hmm. And so the Gnostic Christians come in and they're like, yeah, this is an allegory, but it's an amazing and fascinating allegory. And every sentence is a riddle for us to unpack.
Yeah. So how were the Gnostics able to retell?
To retell the story.
The story.
Well, they noticed something you may have noticed when hearing us read the myth, which is, it kind of seems like a trap.
Uh-huh.
You know, like God builds this garden, creates man, and then it's like, you can do whatever you want here, just don't eat from that one tree.
Yeah, right.
And so it feels like kind of a setup to them.
Mm-hmm.
You also see, if you're paying attention, that God has lied to the humans. He told them they would die if they even touched the tree.
Right.
They didn't die.
Right.
The serpent was not lying, mm-hmm. at least in that part.
Mm-hmm.
And so in many different versions of Gnostic readings of the Eden story, God is a somewhat nefarious character. And there's different interpretations of that. Like in some versions, there's like a higher up God who's just kind of checked out. And the God that created the garden is a demiurge, a smaller God who's just likes to see people suffer and create traps for them.
Yeah. A God not to be trusted.
God not to be trusted. Yeah.
Or some. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I recall this from Gnostic text. Yeah.
Right. So there's that version. And then in a lot of the different Gnostic scriptures, the serpent is actually sort of a hero, a heroic figure.
Yeah.
A figure who is bringing wisdom and awareness to the humans. He is the one who is, or maybe not he, because actually there's a lot of early depictions and even into the Middle Ages, depictions of the serpent as being female.
Uh-huh.
And Peter Gray, in his book Lucifer Princeps, points out that there is a lot of evidence that the serpent is tied to an earlier Sumerian and Akkadian goddess who's both tree and serpent named Asherah.
Right.
So there's this goddess snake deity who has a lot of overlap with the serpent as well.
Yeah. Right. And Genesis is a continuation
of
these characters. Mm-hmm. In a different way.
Right, for sure.
Showing up in a different story and in different ways, but we can learn from the past lives of these characters. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if I gender the serpent male, I'm already making assumptions based on what we've been taught since then, right? Mm-hmm. But in the early days, they either didn't gender the serpent or would often think of the serpent as female.
Right.
In these Gnostic readings, at least.
So in this reading, the God of the Old Testament is maybe not the good God, but is a kind of like a selfish, nefarious demiurge who's not just and just wants power.
He wants power, and his power is arbitrary.
Right.
His rules are arbitrary.
Mm-hmm. And his prescription to not eat of the tree is just something that is not for a good reason.
Mm-hmm.
And then so to eat from that tree is like that transgression is viewed positively.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because...
And the serpent is the one who kind of helps them see that they have a right to do that or something.
Yes. The serpent becomes a divine instructor,
mm-hmm.
a initiatory figure who is telling the humans like that you have this spark of divinity in you. He wants you to not be like him,
mm-hmm.
but you are kind of like him.
Right.
And you could be more like him. And he just doesn't want to share power with you.
Mm-hmm.
And so in many of the Gnostic traditions, there is this current of thinking of humans as having a spark of divinity in us and the capacity for becoming godlike in various ways.
Right. Yeah.
There's a decent amount of evidence that the Gnostic interpretations were partially being influenced by Eastern religion at this time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the as we've been talking about from the beginning of the podcast, people got around a lot.
Yeah.
And this was especially true at this point in history. People got around a lot.
Yeah.
And in this area where this...
In Asia.
In Asia.
I mean, you know, this is part of Asia. Yeah.
Right. Then there was not... there was nothing keeping, except distance, keeping people away mm-hmm. from each other. And so the religious movements and spiritual texts that were blooming and blossoming in South Asia and Eastern Asia were coming west mm-hmm. as well.
It makes sense that the Gnostics would have this take because if you're on an esoteric path mm-hmm. where your desire is to gain more spiritual knowledge and insight, then it's almost like what would you even see yourself as doing besides transcending the limitations of the human?
Right.
In a way.
Right.
Right. So this like primordial transcendence or transgression against mm-hmm. the limits of the human in the Garden of Eden is then sure to be seen as a positive archetype mm-hmm. for what all humans should seek to do.
Right.
Maybe.
Right. Yes. Know?
And then like the God of the Old Testament is just like not only a jealous God, but is like a sort of like a threatened God. Mm-hmm. who needs to maintain his superiority and power and difference from the humans, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's right there in the story. He's right. saying like, oh no, like they can't become too much like me, mm-hmm. you know? And so he punishes them and kicks them out of the garden.
Right.
There's definitely echoes here of the Promethean
yes,
story,
for sure.
right?
Yes.
Because Prometheus brings fire to the humans, which makes them like one step closer to what the gods are able to do.
Right.
And it's the exact same thing. Like Prometheus is punished. I mean, it's the exact same thing in the sense that like the gods want to maintain mm-hmm. a hierarchy.
Right.
And for the humans to learn things that can bring them closer to what the gods can do is not viewed favorably by the gods. Mm-hmm. And so Prometheus is punished for that.
Well, yeah, and also Asclepius, the divine healer, after having figured out how to keep people from dying and bring people back from death, he's struck down by Zeus with a lightning bolt, right? Mm-hmm. So he also is punished for possibly giving access to immortality to humans.
Yeah.
And so there's recurring stories mm-hmm. around this mm-hmm. of these characters who mm-hmm. try to help out mm-hmm. humanity in some way and are punished mm-hmm. by other deities, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah, so that's all in there, for sure, the Promethean reading. Also, some of the sects worship Eve, specifically,
uh-huh.
as the first wise person who understood their spiritual nature and what was possible for us.
Yeah.
What we're capable of.
Right.
Some of the
She wanted more.
She wanted more. And she and she listened.
Yeah.
To the servant.
She heard the call.
She heard the call.
Yeah.
Right. So there's that. There were some sects who actually worshipped the serpent. There's some Ophite sects and Sethian sects who actually worshipped the serpent and used serpents in their rites as well. Mm-hmm. They're pretty interesting. They were taking that particular reading of the story of with the serpent as being held up as the one who's trying to help us and yeah. lead us and guide us, mm-hmm. literally, and used that as a framework for all of their work.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I do want to say, you know, I'm emphasizing the ones I think are more interesting here, but there are a number of Gnostic sects which are pretty dualistic and have a disdain for this world, a disdain for matter, mm-hmm. And for the material realm, who saw the fall as actually our fall into matter. So differentiating into body, into self, mm-hmm. into human is a fall in itself. Mm-hmm. And then you start to see the Platonic influence, right? That there's...
Oh, yeah.
That the differentiation alone, away from the one, is a fall from divinity. So that is a less liberating to me reading of the story. But there were a number of Gnostic readings that contain that part, or contain that perspective.
Right. Got it. Yeah.
Yeah. So as you can see, there's a lot of different ways that people read this story and found interpretations that felt liberating to them. And I didn't mention this at the beginning, but I'll say it now, that most of what we, meaning scholars, readers, knew of the Gnostic Christians came from their critics until pretty recently, actually, because the Orthodox Christians, or what the people who were seeking to create a unified version of Christianity with one story, one scripture, or set of scriptures, and a sort of hierarchy of power within the Christian church, worked very, very hard to eliminate the Gnostic teachings. And they did a really good job. None of these texts survived, or at least none were known to have survived from the original writers. and we only were able to read criticisms of them. And that criticism was still happening even to the work of St. Augustine. He spent some time and energy talking about how the Gnostics were wrong.
Right.
So that's in around 400, current era, just for context. But every single Orthodox Christian who wrote what we should be believing, what the Bible should say, and who we're trying to consolidate, always took some time to trash talk the Gnostics.
Yeah.
So it must have been pervasive enough for that to be important. Mm-hmm. So that was all that existed or had been, was left, was the criticism for a long time. In 1945, in some sealed ceramic canisters in a graveyard in Egypt, in Nag Hammadi, Egypt, they found these canisters containing the Nag Hammadi, what are now called the Nag Hammadi Gospels or the Nag Hammadi Codex. And these are actual Gnostic scriptures.
Quite randomly.
Totally randomly.
It was a very random find. Yeah.
They were doing something else there. Yeah. That story is its own wild tale of why they were in the graveyard and what they were doing. Yeah. But they were digging around.
And they didn't know what they had found. No. I mean, it was all, these are not like scholars that were digging for anything. No. It was all,
Right. They found.
It's fascinating.
It's an amazing story. They found, at least 1,500-year-old, possibly 2,000-year-old.
Manuscripts,
papyri with Gnostic gospels written on them. And they didn't know what they had. In fact, their mother burnt some of them making a fire in the kitchen. And so for a few years, the people, they figured out they were worth something. They didn't want to just be forced to hand them over to the museums by the state. And so they were kind of on the black market for a while. Interestingly, Carl Jung ended up with them because someone was able to obtain them and gave them to him as a birthday present.
Yeah.
Which is so wild, but like anyway.
What at that point was still just like a curiosity.
A curiosity, right.
Maybe, yes. Right? Not totally known yet how important they were.
But
maybe,
eventually people figured out what they were.
Yeah.
And they are now back in the Coptic Museum in Egypt. Coptic, by the way, is a word for Egyptian Christians. And these were actually...
That's the language.
And that group of people are sometimes referred to as Coptic Christians as well. But the language is Coptic. It had been translated from the Greek. And so it's not the originals, but it's a translation of the originals.
Yeah.
Possibly written in that language to protect them somewhat as well. But there are translations you can now get of most of those, I think. There is a Gospel of Mary Magdalene. There's a Gospel of Eve. Actually, Gospel of Eve might still be missing. But
you may have heard of the Gospel of Thomas.
Gospel of Thomas is
one of the most famous.
That's a famous one for sure.
These Gnostic Gospels,
Right. So a lot of the work, a lot of the scholarship around this that's happened in the last, well, now it's been 70 years, has been done by people who are actually able to return to these texts and read about the Gnostics in their own words. So just to say, this was an exciting find, and people are still decoding some of these manuscripts and still working in them.
So from what you said about the Gnostic readings, it sounds like to them in general, I'm sure there's lots of Gnostic readings, but the juiciest, most salient, most important part of the story is the eating of the fruit and what's gained by that.
Yes.
Right? Because the eating of the fruit is the knowledge of good and evil, and that stands for the type of gnosis, or at least a facet of the gnosis that the Gnostics were seeking.
Right.
So, for them, Eve is like herself a Gnostic.
Right.
In a way. I mean, I don't, I'm kind of playing around with this, but like, the significant thing that is to be read into is that to eat of this tree is to partake in an aspect of divinity or divine gnosis in some way, and that is almost like the act that founds their sect or their tradition. And so they see Eve as like a ancestor kind of in this way.
Right.
And that the prohibition against doing that was an unjust prohibition by a demiurge who does not want humans to ascend.
Right. Yeah.
Would that be maybe a fair way of summarizing?
Right. And wants to create obstacles to humans fulfilling their potential.
Yeah.
and see who they really are.
Right.
You know, I was just thinking, I mean, I don't want to dismiss this story or downplay it, but there are still just so many modern iterations of this. And, you know, this has been basically hijacked by the far right, but The Matrix is a Gnostic story. You know, it's absolutely a story in which, do you want to know what's going on? Or do you want to keep the fantasy of what's going on? You know?
Right.
And the perceived world of the people who are within the Matrix is created by these beings who feed off of them. You know? But then they have to choose whether or not to take the pill that will give them knowledge of what's actually happening. And allow them agency in their lives.
But it's like, in the Matrix, it's the truth about your exploitation and who is like feeding off of you and what to what lengths they've gone to keep you unable to even realize, much less rebel against the way you're being fed off of, like your vitality is being sucked out or something. Which there are some particularly modern dimensions to that that are like maybe not totally present in the Garden of Eden story.
You know, some of the Gnostic versions have these archons who do feed on human suffering, who are part of who created the world. And and like what you're pointing to is actually something, there's a part I haven't talked about within the Gnostic reading, which is that they didn't believe that Adam created suffering by making that choice after Eve made the choice, because they didn't believe that there was a time before there was suffering for humans. And that's important here. They, and I think actually kind of goes with what the Davids are saying, you know, I mean, the Gnostics were like, well, there's always suffering. Life is suffering. It's good and bad. This is part of what being alive means.
Right.
You know, there wasn't a moment that it entered our lives.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. You know, and so some of their readings took that to an extreme to be like, it's actually created to create, the world is created to make suffering. Because there are beings, a being or multiple beings, feeding on this suffering who enjoy it.
Yeah.
You know, and so there are some versions of it that look like that.
Yeah.
That's not what we're highlighting here. But I do think that the Matrix reading would be more analogous with those life is suffering, they're evil beings in charge version of the Gnostic scriptures. So, but yes, in general, with what we're talking about with the liberatory reading, then
the liberation is in the eating of the apple.
In the eating of the apple. It's like you get...
And what's gained by that.
What's gained by that. Yeah. Right. And partially it's the removal of the illusions in the Matrix and in many tellings of the story. And probably there were a number of Gnostic sects who also thought that that it was seeing through the illusions. You know, they had some version of Maya in their framework for how the world works as well, you know.
Yeah.
So seeing through the veil behind the veil is part of Gnosis.
Cool. Very cool.
Gnostic scholars, and by that I mean people who have studied the Gnostics, not, although some of them might be.
Scholars of Gnosticism.
Scholars of Gnosticism have a concept that they used to use. It's kind of gone out of fashion for understanding what the Gnostic Christians were doing. And it's protest exegesis. I learned this term from Per Faxneld's book, Satanic Feminism, which we will link to in the notes. But in that book, he's discussing various Luciferian and satanic currents through literature and art. And that creature as a symbol, which sometimes is a serpent because of the conflation that happens later. But he introduces this term from Gnostic scholarship, which is protest exegesis, in which people will reinterpret a story to make it more liberating. And now the general consensus of scholars of Gnosticism is that that's not actually what these Gnostic Christians were doing. They weren't going, what if we made the serpent the hero? They actually thought that was the story. And they were interpreting the story from direct spiritual revelation in a way that was not an alternate proposal, but just the interpretation.
Right. Where protest exegesis is a specifically I don't want to call it reactive, but it's
like a little reactive.
It's yeah.
It's intentional.
It's intentionally coming up with an interpretation that differs from the orthodox one.
Right.
As an act of protest.
And in inverting
like that is. Yeah.
You're inverting it.
Inversion.
God is the enemy.
Yeah, God is the enemy.
The serpent is the hero.
Is the hero.
Eve is the hero. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's an inversion and
You, like, set out to do that.
Right.
Yes.
And part of the reason that this is not the consensus anymore with scholars of Gnosticism is that what the Gnostic Christians were interpreting was not a set in stone at all. There was not one interpretation for them to be rejecting and inverting. And importantly, for what we're about to talk about, there was no concept of original sin. Eve was not considered the problem in the story at that point, even by Orthodox readings.
Uh-huh.
And there was less emphasis on gender in general.
Yeah.
And that all enters the picture with St. Augustine.
Right.
Or Augustine, depending on how you're pronouncing his name. Mm-hmm. But most...
Augustine of Hippo.
Augustine of Hippo. St. Augustine, who wrote his more famous texts around 400... current era.
The Confessions.
And he was still talking shit about the Gnostics because they were still around.
Yeah.
But he is who said, this is when the fateful change happened. Mm-hmm. We are all born with the original sin of Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
None of us is clean.
Right.
And we enter this world of sin and in sin.
Right.
And that interpretation, including the heavy emphasis on women as the problem and women as evil, was the interpretation a lot of people were using as just what the Garden of Eden means for a long time. So for you to look back in the Gnostic era and think they were inverting that, they didn't even really have that yet.
Right.
You know? So this is why now scholars of Gnosticism think that actually they probably weren't inverting or protesting. They were just interpreting, and their interpretation looked different than the Orthodox interpretation.
Right.
But...
And to say it again, Augustine's interpretation is the really, I mean, kind of perverse, and not just perverse moralistically or whatever, but also it's a stretch to make this interpretation. It's not, not just what the story is or whatever, but... Augustine's interpretation is that not only did Adam and Eve do bad and suffer the consequences, but we are born already guilty of the same crime they did.
Right.
Right? It's like original, that is original sin.
Right.
Is that we are born sinners for being like in the lineage of Adam and Eve.
Human, yeah. Yes.
And that, like, their sin just reverberates through all of our generations.
Right.
And can only be finally atoned for in the last judgment.
Yeah.
Basically.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And it's this interpretation that is the one that's being mirrored in any story of humanity that contains a fall that we can't come back from.
And because the story has become associated with sexuality, this is also has a lot to say about Christianity's obsession with...
Prohibitions on sex.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And extreme misogyny.
Uh-huh.
It didn't... Misogyny, again, and patriarchy do not begin with these interpretations of the Garden of Eden. In fact, pre-Christian society in this area... where, you know, in the Mesopotamian region was alive and well and flourishing at that point. And in fact, the misogyny and patriarchy of ancient Greece is mind-blowing when you actually begin to read up on it.
Yeah.
And that was the context with which a lot of this was drawn as well. It's just that Augustine, he created a sort of framework and tool to really punish women, to further limit women's actions and control their behavior in a way that one could not really grow out of because it's essential to our nature to be the temptress, the devil's gateway. Someone else actually said that, but well, it's a good here. The devil's gateway and the tool for the devil to corrupt men, basically. Because by the time Augustine comes around, the devil's starting to be conflated with the serpent.
Okay.
And yeah, again, that's a long and complicated history, but there's already starting to be some conflation there for various reasons that have to do with the fact that, as the Gnostics understood, part of what's confusing about the Garden of Eden story is that you're supposed to have this all good God who set you up, mm-hmm. who created the serpent. So everything God created, he's supposed to be all good, but also he kind of created a messy situation where you might were set up to fail. There needed to be a way to explain there being evil in the world when there's an all good God.
Mm-hmm.
And so they needed a bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so a bad guy was crafted over time.
Yeah.
Is the short version of the story.
Right.
Because you can't have an all good God and have evil in the world.
Mm-hmm.
If there's not some other characters around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one of the contradictions of monotheism. Anyway, back to protest exegesis here. So we do see protest exegesis later in interpretations of the Garden of Eden. And actually that phrase, that concept, is incredibly helpful as we move into the Victorian era.
Okay.
So we talked about this some in the Gardens of Adonis episode when we talked about matriarchy and
primitive matriarchy,
matriarchy.
Neolithic matriarchy.
Yes.
Yeah. And like the partisans of Neolithic matriarchy in form of like Matilda Jocelyn Gage and all these people. Yeah.
So we've referred to this a little bit already, but just to return to it, the era of the Victorian era, so like late 1800s, going in early 1900s, the serpent, and I'm going to be going back and forth between serpent and Lucifer now for a little while, because at this point they've been somewhat conflated.
Right.
And usually people aren't talking about Satan because they want to emphasize Lucifer as Lightbringer. Lucifer literally means Lightbringer.
Mm-hmm.
And
these people who you're about to talk
about.
The
people I'm about to talk about are people who embraced Lucifer as symbol and serpent as symbol.
Uh-huh.
And they did so because political theorists, bohemians, occultists, there's this mishmash at that time of people, fellow travelers who were into criticizing society as a whole and working for change together from various means.
Sure.
And they identified Lucifer as being the teacher, the divine instructor, the person who, the archetype of the rebel, and often actually a symbol of progress. Because there was this idealization at that point of people just like learning more, growing more, reading more, and becoming more evolved as humans, individually and societally.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason Lucifer became a powerful symbol for folks at this time is that they began to understand, partially through exposure to other cultures around the world, as we've talked about earlier in the season, that Christianity had a particularly gnarly influence on how people were being dominated and was a tool of the state, and in fact was completely complicit with the state and with a colonial project to oppress people and keep people from, this is going to sound familiar, fulfilling their potential. Again, as individuals and as a society, and from working together to create a better world.
Right.
And so during the Victorian era, there became an identification with the Garden of Eden story of God with the ruling class for some people.
Mm-hmm.
And some people just sort of did this rhetorically, like Proudhon has passages where he talks about Lucifer as like this rebel and the working class is fighting against God. But he was a pretty conservative Christian, actually.
Yeah.
He was just an anti-cleric. But so even people like that would use Lucifer as a symbol sometimes for fun.
Right.
You know. But Mikhail Bakunin, who was a avowed atheist in public, but apparently had some secret pagan religion that he had with his sisters, he would use Lucifer regularly as a symbol of enlightenment and as and would critique the traditional Orthodox Christian God as a tool of the state and as equivalent to the state. He has a book called God and the State that is about that.
God as the oppressor.
Yes, right.
And these early chapters of Genesis are not the only place where you could mm-hmm. find evidence for God as the oppressor.
Right. Right.
I mean, God as authoritarian, obviously.
Right, right, right.
And therefore a fit target for rebellion.
Right.
For anti-authoritarian rebellion.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then so Adam and Eve and the serpent mm-hmm. are the rebels against the authoritarian God.
Absolutely.
The authoritarian order. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I actually, I have something else to say about that, but I wanted to just also place us in history and time. You know, I kind of jumped from 400 to the late 1800s. We could argue that there's some Ophidian currents that are going through, like the movement of the free spirit and some other times mm-hmm. in which people found Lucifer / serpent to be an empowering symbol teacher.
Yeah.
Figure. But I did want to say that Lucifer got a boost. So the Romantic writers of England and Western Europe were really into Lucifer as a symbol as well. We're just not talking about literature a ton here.
Yeah.
Although there's a rich and beautiful tradition within literature of people using Lucifer as a symbol and the serpent as a symbol.
Mm-hmm.
Shelley does so, Lord Byron. But those Romantics and proto-Romantics, like William Blake, were particularly inspired by Milton's representation of Lucifer in Paradise Lost.
Yeah.
You know? And
yeah,
so
absolutely.
Even though he was like a Puritan, he was a Puritan who was attempting to write the story of the fall in a way that was a morality tale.
Yeah.
The most shining character is Lucifer.
Right.
You know, and I just want to read this one quote because I think it's really good. But
yeah.
that piece of poetry had a huge impact in a way that was not intended by Milton, presumably as a conservative Puritan.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah.
We love it. We love to see it.
We love to see it. But William Blake, proto-romantic printmaker, poet, artist.
It was a quote from Blake.
It's a quote from Blake.
Not from Paradise.
Said of John Milton.
Yeah.
He said Milton wrote in fetters when he wrote of angels and God, and at liberty when of devils and hell, because he was a true poet and of the devil's party without knowing it.
Yeah. So a true poet is of the devil's party, according to Blake.
According to Blake, mm-hmm. yeah. So he made these beautiful prints of Lucifer.
Yeah.
That go along with Paradise Lost. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he's very mm-hmm. handsome mm-hmm. in these prints.
Yeah.
But
so Lucifer as light bringer is also pretty interesting here.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Right. So like it's not just Lucifer as a rebel.
Right.
And like we like the rebel and therefore we like Lucifer, but it's also, you know, Lucifer the name mm-hmm. means light bringer.
Mm-hmm.
And the light that Lucifer is bringing is also open to interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah,
so
for, sure.
for the Gnostics, it might be the light of Gnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Although Lucifer wasn't the serpent in the Gnostic stories, but if you were a Gnostic today, you could see it that way.
Yeah. Current Gnostic traditions, because there are some,
yeah.
do that. Yes.
Right. Yeah. But at the time of like Bakunin, it would maybe be the light of class consciousness, or the light at the end of the tunnel of revolutionary struggle, or something like
yeah.
that. And maybe there's echoes of the Enlightenment as well.
There's a lot of progress.
Like the light of reason and progress, mm-hmm. or like a kind of order for mm-hmm. humanity that is revealed by reason rather than handed down by the priests or something.
Money or power or...
Yeah.
Institutional power
mm-hmm.
against institutional power,
mm-hmm.
Which keeps people ignorant. So mm-hmm. there are echoes of Gnosticism here.
Mm-hmm.
The church and state as keeping people illiterate, uneducated, and in the dark.
Yeah.
And away from their mm-hmm. potential as individuals and as a collective.
Right.
You know?
Right. That's part of the historical context for what we're talking about here.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And a lot of different, there are many journals. Anarchist journals, socialist journals, there's a lot of overlap. There are feminist journals that were called Lucifer or would regularly use Luciferian imagery in their work and art.
Yeah,
There was no
so interesting.
It's super interesting. There was a pretty prominent one in Sweden, but also in the U.S. at the time, there was a journal that started in Kansas and it had like a much longer and clunkier name, but then they relocated to Chicago and it became Lucifer the Lightbringer,
mm-hmm.
and it was a regular journal that began as more anarchist became and turned sort of anarcho-feminist over time, we're consistently talking about sexual liberation, which in this case means actually like not being controlled by one's husband, having the right to not have sex with one's husband, these kinds of things, sexual autonomy. At the same time as talking about class consciousness. And Moses Harman, I think, was the editor of that journal. And he did prison time multiple times for hosting conversations around sex and freedom. And people would his critics would call it the satanic journal. But really, it was like very symbolic. Most of these, most of these people were not practicing any sort of religion or spiritual framework in relationship to this Luciferian imagery or serpent-centered imagery, you know? Just to be clear, like, I'm not calling all of these people Satanists. They were not, or Luciferians, or Gnostics, but they really liked the imagery of that and saw that the church would have to lose power for society to change at that point.
And the Garden of Eden story, just to bring it back to that, is being mobilized by these folks, you know, aside from just valorizing Lucifer. The Garden of Eden story itself is important in, like, reclaiming the serpent slash Lucifer as, like, the righteous, like, rebel.
Well, yeah.
And then also for, like, women's liberation.
Right, yeah. Definitely that. Before I leave that, I will also say that Bakunin...
And sexual liberation.
Bakunin would cite the Garden of Eden story as the original myth showing that rebellion is an inherent part of our nature and that we must rebel.
Oh, right.
And so there's also...
So providing an insight into human nature.
There's a human nature aspect and humans as rebels and changers and world shapers, you know. That's going to come in. We're going to talk about that some more later. But but just to say the rebellion aspect for a lot of these more revolutionary thinkers is really important. And it's not, and they might even shift away from Lucifer to say like Adam and Eve are the rebels.
Yeah.
And importantly for us, because of what we were talking about on the last episode, the feminist readers of this time especially valorized Eve. And this is what you're getting at, which is that Eve as the person with insight, the person who was willing to listen and see the way forward, the person who was receptive to wisdom. This was a Gnostic theme for the early Christian Gnostics, but then also became an important theme for various members of the women's movement, especially in the United States at the time, the late 1800s. And there were a couple of suffragettes, women associated with the suffrage movement, who were eventually kicked out, one of which we talked about already, Matilda Jocelyn Gage, but also Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Elizabeth Cady Stanton put out a book called The Women's Bible, and she had a committee of 26 women, and they worked on all these different pieces about the Bible. Some of them were Christian women who wanted to reinterpret or to question and throw off the interpretation of various parts of the Bible, but still wanted to hold on to it. Some of them were vehemently anti-Christian. Gage was more of that party. And they wanted to just dismiss the Bible wholesale and say this is just used to keep us down and control us. Some of those same women were interested in using the Garden of Eden story in a more liberatory way to give examples of how God is an oppressive force and works with the oppressors to keep people from enlightenment and from change.
Yeah.
You know, and so they did use that story, even if they didn't necessarily believe it. Some of them were theosophists. I'm not going to go into theosophy a lot today for a lot of reasons. So they did have some kind of spiritual practice that did contain Lucifer, but it's pretty murky and a lot to explain. But what I will say is they did want to retell those stories with Eve as a hero, a heroic figure.
Yeah.
Who is shining the way for progress and out of this like dark time of patriarchy, basically. Interestingly, part of what the project is about was about for them, which is probably hard for us to, well, it might not be that hard for us to imagine at the point that we are with a Christo-fascist influence in this country, at least. But the Garden of Eden was being used in pretty insidious ways that directly affected women's lives at this point. Part of what you learn from reading this history is that in the late 1800s, there were medical innovations happening that could help childbirth be less painful.
Yeah.
And like some kinds of anesthesia. Some of them were used too much. There's a long history of that as well. But there were ways to make childbirth less deadly and less painful. And some Victorian era doctors here and in Europe would say, we can't do that because they're supposed to suffer. They're supposed to be in pain. That's God's will. We can't make childbirth easier.
Right.
And so they would be using this as a literal story to say, like, why women need to suffer in childbirth.
Mm-hmm.
And so any way that these feminists could undermine the literal reading of the text, even by showing that there are 100 possible readings, was a way they could actually point to there being more possibility for women.
Yeah.
You know? And, I mean, we've talked about this before, but it's interesting because these same doctors who were arguing for why women should suffer and possibly die in childbirth were probably not arguing for innovation, any innovations that made agriculture easier.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you know? Right. That's, yeah, that's been pointed out.
Right.
Right, is that Adam gets a relief from his toil.
Right.
But Eve does not get a relief from her suffering.
Right.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And that's part of what those feminists of the Victorian era were saying, is just that women, like, this is a tool for punishing women. This is entirely a tool for punishing women, and we need to throw it out. Mm-hmm. Some of them, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
We're saying we should throw it out. And Matilda Joslyn Gage specifically saw church and state as absolutely a pair that worked together to deny liberty to everyone except for the ruling elite. And that the various machinations of misogyny were part of that tool, you know, that we can keep women and men apart, we can give men power over women, and that way that authoritarian power rewards some groups against others, keeps people divided, like, she understood all that and wrote about that. Mm-hmm. And that was her critique of how much the Bible was influencing society at that point.
Yeah.
Interestingly, the more conservative elements of that women's movement, like Susan B. Anthony and others, they were not into the women's Bible being published. They were really worried that that would be used to demonize their movement and punish women in general and keep women from getting ahead. And that did happen. I mean, the work of these anti-Christian feminists was pointed to try to dismiss the whole project. But this is another time that we can point to the fact that the more radical feminist understood that just getting women the vote was not enough and was not going to actually cause much change. Again, I just like to emphasize those people who were working for more fundamental change at different points in history who get erased, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Matilda Joslyn Gage, her family house was always a stop on the Underground Railroad.
Yeah.
She was an active abolitionist. She faced prison time for that work. So outside of her abolitionism of the moment, she also, you know, was writing books like Woman, Church, and the State that were just like, this all has to be abolished.
Yeah.
We have to get rid of all of these structures that are keeping us from being free. And so,
what a badass.
She was a badass. And also she you can see the resonance and the reverberations of those Gnostic readings where there are like, there are powers in place who want to keep us from doing what we can do together. But she's talking more in a societal way and less on the individual level, right?
Right.
So that's going to be important for us as well as we move forward.
Wow, cool. Well, yeah, thanks for all that. That's very illuminating.
I'm the serpent.
I wanted to close out just by, you know, kind of summarizing some thoughts that I was having along these lines actually a few years ago, where I put together this little talk that I led that I called What Are Humans For? And it was inspired by thinking about the Garden of Eden, actually, after having read Peter Gray's book, Lucifer Princeps, which Janet mentioned a little bit earlier, which has a lot of just like really dazzling scholarship about the evolution of this concept of Lucifer, Satan, the devil, the adversary, and includes
the serpent,
a chapter on the Garden of Eden.
Mm-hmm.
But also thinking about humans on the earth and thinking ecologically also about human evolution. I mean, actually thinking about a lot of what the dawn of everything is about,
mm-hmm.
about the story of humanity.
Mm-hmm. I mean, in your talk, you even talked about Göbekli Tepe. Like, you touched on various points.
Right, it was also inspired by the revelation about Göbekli Tepe being built by hunter-gatherers and all. So, yeah, this was in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And that talk took up the story of the Garden of Eden in a little bit of a different way than mm-hmm. we've been emphasizing so far,
mm-hmm.
where the Gnostic stories, you know, I mean, they're all kind of approaching all the facets of the story, but where in the Gnostic stories, there's a lot of importance put on what it means to eat of the tree of knowledge.
Right.
And also what it means that we're forbidden from doing so,
mm-hmm.
you know, but the emphasis is on what we can gain by eating it.
Right.
And how that was ultimately the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And in these Victorian stories, the emphasis is kind of on the power dynamics
mm-hmm.
and the god of Genesis as an authoritarian mm-hmm. oppressor, and then the serpent as the instigator of rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
But in my engagement with the Garden of Eden story, I think what I was trying to take seriously the possibility that the Garden of Eden story is about, or can be read as being about, humans somehow like crossing a threshold
mm-hmm.
into some new possibility, some new terrain, some mm-hmm. new way of being that is attractive yet also kind of risky.
Mm-hmm. Or part of what I remember from your talk is that it was kind of based on the understanding and awareness that humans throughout time know we are different from other animals in some ways.
Yeah.
And then a lot of myths and stories and frameworks for life
mm-hmm.
Address that. You know, a lot mm-hmm. of the world's
mm-hmm.
lore
right.
is trying to get at why are we different and what is different about us.
Yeah, right. I'm glad you were, yeah, yes. Because that is definitely another piece that was kind of being incorporated mm-hmm. in that is this... Right. This idea that is also expressed in myth from mm-hmm. around the world about what it means to be human,
mm-hmm.
right? And how humans, you know, from like a biological perspective, we know that humans are just, that we are just an animal
mm-hmm.
among all the other animals.
Right.
And live on the earth just like the other animals. However, history has shown that we are an animal that has had this very outsized impact on the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of different theories about what our impact can be attributed to. Consciousness, tool using,
mm-hmm.
fire.
Language.
Language. All these things that...
Awareness of our own death.
That seem to mark us off as being somewhat different.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, in what I was thinking at that time, I was kind of going into this territory that the Davids maybe don't like
mm-hmm.
as, you know, seeing, like trying to go towards this idea of the Garden of Eden being, if not a fall narrative, at mm-hmm. least a story of like a momentous change,
mm-hmm.
you know, and maybe something that can't be undone. And what I was inclined to embrace, at least in that kind of thought experiment, was that maybe that story is about humans' ability to have this enormous impact on the earth,
mm-hmm.
on the land,
mm-hmm.
on the habitat that we inhabit.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, all animals have an impact, but I think we, you know, it can maybe be like reasonably said that we have the ability to have a huge impact.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And an outsized one, even, you know, people, you point this out sometimes that people try to remind us of our animal nature will be like, we're ecosystem engineers,
mm-hmm.
you know, but
yeah.
you know, we're doing a little bit more than a beaver.
Keystone species,
yeah,
but there's lots of different keystone.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, maybe it's not faded from like a very early history, but at least in historical time, looking backwards, we mm-hmm. can say that like we have differentiated ourselves
mm-hmm.
from the rest of the animals.
And our
you
capacity
know, from the rest of the critters.
Our capacity
for better
world,
or for worse.
For world shaping is
yeah.
is on a at this point right. we can say our capacity for world shaping mm-hmm. is on par with that of a big meteorite
yeah.
hitting the earth.
Right.
You know?
Right.
We are very
for better or for worse.
Right, yes.
And that for better or for worse part is what's encapsulated in the Garden of Eden story, kind of, right? Because there's something that's gained in having that power, but then there's also something terrible.
Right.
Or at the very least risky about having that power.
There's something about, I mean, I think consciousness as an interpretation of eating of the fruit of the tree of knowledge makes sense. Gaining consciousness makes sense to me there, because it's like you,
they become
self-aware, you know, and it's not that I don't think other animals are sentient, but there's a level to which there is consciousness
But it's hard to reduce it, because what is it? I mean, is it consciousness, or like arguably our first step in being able to vastly influence ecosystems is actually fire.
Right.
Just like in the Promethean myth.
Uh-huh.
You know, and does it take consciousness to have fire? I don't know. I mean, you know, all that stuff is wrapped up. It's hard to really pull out one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But wherever you locate it, it's not agriculture.
Right.
You know, I mean, I'm definitely taking this
for much further back
to, I mean, even before Homo sapiens.
I would say that wherever, too. I was going to say other hominids would probably also fall into this, right? If we think about what we have seen with the other.
But it's important that, at least in the way I was thinking through these ideas, I'm trying not to talk about a fall.
Mm-hmm.
It's still, like, it might be engaging with a Garden of Eden type story, but not as a fall in the sense of like a bad decision, a bad shift. You know, it might be pushing a boundary, it might be crossing a threshold, you know, but the moral dimension of the Garden of Eden is you shouldn't have done that. It was wrong. It was a sin, and now you're punished, you know, and the interpretations that put agriculture as the fall kind of keep that moral dimension.
Right.
Where it's like, oh, you shouldn't have done that. Now look, there's no going back from agriculture now. You know, oh, you know, now we live with the consequences. And in this taking it further back, you know, I'm inspired by Peter Gray and the way that he goes back to the pre-Judaic roots of the Garden of Eden story, where he, I thought convincingly, you know, in his scholarship, shows that what we know as the Garden of Eden story, the story of the serpent and the tree, is a later repurposing of what had at one time been an initiation ritual.
Right.
An initiation rite.
Right.
Involving the serpent, who is like one of humanity's oldest spirit companions.
Absolutely.
Showing up in myth from around the world. Mm-hmm. As one of the earliest animals to be recognized in myth. An initiation ritual where the serpent participates in the initiation of first Eve. And then she is the initiator of Adam.
Right.
Right. And what they're being initiated into is this mystery of being human in this way that is, in some hard to describe way, being different from the other animals. And that with this crossing this threshold, the template here is very much being initiated into a cultic order or being initiated into adulthood and having to take on the greater power, but also the greater responsibility that comes with, you know, growing up.
Right.
Coming into adulthood.
Right.
And that maybe there's something in this telling of the Garden of Eden story originally that maybe it could be seen as people reckoning with crossing the threshold into this outsized power to change the earth and to affect the other animals, but also the responsibility that comes with that. You know, and so not a fall, but an initiation into greater power and responsibility.
Right. That's a really beautiful and powerful reading of that story, I think. And you're reminding me, you know, to get back to what you, I think we mentioned earlier, but, you know, there's consistently sexual readings of the story of the Garden of Eden, and there being some kind of sexual knowledge as part of it. And it just makes me think about one thing that humans...
Yeah, so where does that part fit?
Well, humans... among the many ways that we have seen ourselves as being different from other animals and from plants is that we don't just have sex to reproduce.
Yeah.
We have sex mm-hmm. in all kinds of ways. They are mm-hmm. not all about generation.
Mm-hmm.
We don't only have sex when we're fertile,
mm-hmm.
even if we are having the kind of sex that could get one of us pregnant.
Yeah.
We have all kinds of sex with all kinds of bodies.
Yeah.
We always have. Queerness has always been here as well, you know, right. and queer practices.
Yeah.
But also compare, you know, there are some other primates like bonobos who have sex when they're not fertile and
uh-huh.
who have uh-huh. Same-sex coupling and masturbation and all of those things to a large degree or as a large practice of their cultures.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, we are very noteworthy for being animals who have sex whenever we feel like it.
Yep.
And who even want to have sex outside of when it would be good for us for reproducing.
Yeah.
You know,
right. and that's we're not just horny for a reproductive purpose.
Purposes.
Yeah.
There's something that makes humans different that has to do with sex. And I think people mm-hmm. have always known that and
yeah.
have noticed that and have talked about that.
Right.
And so the way that the Garden of Eden story is an origin story, a creation myth,
uh-huh.
that's in there.
Yeah.
You know?
And is it just in there too?
Yes.
You know, like there's yes. more than one thing in there.
Right.
Or is that somehow wrapped up in the other thing? Mm-hmm. I mean, I could stretch here. I could go out on a limb and say and suggest that maybe the positive purpose of humanity, the biodiversity increasing ecosystemic abundance creation that is possible for humans when mm-hmm. we're in right relationship is fecund
right.
and
right.
fertile in a way that is redolent of sexuality
mm-hmm.
in a way,
mm-hmm.
even if it's not about biological reproduction,
mm-hmm.
you know? But admittedly, that's a stretch.
I like the idea that wild tending and ecosystem enrichment would be part yeah. of this story.
Yes.
I mean, I also think about how our aptitude for consciousness / self-awareness, creative imagination,
mm-hmm.
capacity mm-hmm. is what allows us to have pleasure at all kinds of times and not just in fertile times,
mm-hmm.
but also allows us to create art and beauty and writing and literature. And while some people see those as part of the fall,
mm-hmm.
you know, I like to think about that as those as part of our flowering.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, me too.
So if you see
right.
consciousness as this responsibility that has the capacity for beauty and possibly destruction and both all of the time, and sometimes they're part of each other,
mm-hmm.
then us stepping into our responsibility mm-hmm. and claiming that through the initiation that often includes sex,
yeah,
not always,
yep.
Then we are claiming what makes us human
uh-huh.
and accepting the responsibility of wielding that power
right.
wisely.
Right.
You know,
right.
and from that will come all manner of beautiful things,
mm-hmm.
but then
mm-hmm.
a vast array of ways of doing harm mm-hmm. as well.
Right.
They're both in there, you know?
Right.
And perhaps that's the fruit of the tree,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to say one more mm-hmm. thing before I think we're probably wrapping it up here, but I was thinking about another more contemporary cultural manifestation of the Gnostic way of thinking are the Philip Pullman trilogy, His Dark Materials.
Oh, yeah.
And in it, which if you haven't read those, it might be too young an adult for some people, but they're pretty good tellings of this Gnostic story.
It's a good read.
Yeah, it's a good read of the
yeah,
Gnostic
I think
version.
Even for grown-ups.
Yeah. But there is a part where the Garden of Eden story is happening again. I don't think this is too much of a spoiler. You'll still be surprised, I think, when it comes.
Yeah.
I've reread them, and I'm still like, oh, right. But there's a part where the person who is playing the part of a serpent, somewhat unconsciously,
mm-hmm.
this physicist, she talks about how she had been a nun, and she quit being a nun because she began to understand that sexual knowledge and awareness and consciousness and moving through the world without as many rules, even like the capacity to like make decisions every day to be embodied and to feel pleasure was like part of our inheritance as humans. And that word, the way that she talks about that is, has really stuck with me. And I think about, if I think about what we gain in the Garden of Eden as our inheritance rather than a fall, then it really helps me think about that story in a way that is not only liberating, but actually it's generative. It gives me a lot to work with, you know? And I think that I, as I see more and more theory and activism around embracing pleasure, around embracing embodiment, and actually trying to create the world we want to live in as we go, which is very Graeber, David Graeber type concept. Then I do think there's something for us in this story, if we think about it in the way that you are, which is initiatory, refusing to have the dominant power structure tell us how to interpret the story.
Right.
Throwing out the idea of the fall and embracing the idea of claiming responsibility and living up to our potential as humans.
Yeah, coming into a potential that has risks and gifts and being able to manage those. Well,
yeah. So to wrap it up, I wanted to think about the individual versus the collective a little bit. And just that, so in case people, listeners, don't know, there are contemporary Luciferian traditions. There's contemporary Ophidian occult traditions. There are, we're not going to name a lot of lineages here, but there are...
There won't be links in the show notes to these.
There won't be links into the show notes into those more secret societies who are doing this work, but they do exist. You know, this is a loud current that is still out there. Unfortunately, I think most of us probably have been more, are more exposed to some of the cheesier versions of Luciferianism, like Anton LaVey's Satanism, you know,
and so
you're just kind of eye-rolly and it's a little embarrassing, in that these tend to be, attract people who are interested in gaining individual power, people who want power over rather than power to, and they tend to not emphasize collective struggle or collective work, collective liberation. And, you know, we could point to ways you could see that beginning even in the Victorian era with some of the readings of Luciferianism. But what I'm interested in is, what does the Garden of Eden story say that for the collective? You know, and if I do use your interpretation, and which I think is a compelling one, which is that we are stepping into, we are being initiated into responsibility for what we as a species are capable of.
Power and responsibility.
Power and responsibility.
Right. And then what's the liberatory dimension of that?
And potentially? What's the liberatory potential of that, I think, is, and to tie it back to the dawn of everything, that we have the capacity to change our material conditions. That we have the capacity to assess, to problem solve, to work together, to build worlds, as well as we have the possibility of destroying worlds. I mean, as
to change worlds.
To change worlds.
Yeah. And to remake the world.
Right. All of that is in that fruit as well. You know, but we don't want to read the narrative as a political fall that we can't go back from. And we don't want to read the Garden of Eden narrative as a why humans suck narrative, which I feel like a lot of people who maybe mean well end up dismissing our entire species as doomed to destroy and as inherently desiring of abusing power and dominating others. You know, all of that is something that some people see as part of our species as birthright or something, or or our destiny. So reading it as a moment in which we step into our power in a way that does not assume a positive or negative outcome, but one in which our power to perceive and make choices and shape change have to actually be wielded with intention.
And that the same powers that were used to get us to where we are are the powers that will be used to get us to where we'd rather be.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's it.
I think that's it. I think we solved the problems.
I think that's it.
All right, next time we'll be getting back to the book.
Oh, yeah, we're going to do chapter 7 next time. Is that right?
Yeah.
The What's Ecology of Freedom.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, more on farming.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I'm glad we took a little detour back to the garden before we talk about farming some more.
Yeah, I got to get reading.
Me too.
Yeah. Okay, we'll see you all next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Deer at dusk, buzzard at dawn, big old frog singing in the pond. Earth wakes up. Deer at dusk, buzzard at dawn, big old frog singing in the pond. Earth wakes up. Earth wakes up. Oh.